Today's class or discourse will be divided into three sections. The first, our little discussion section prepared for us. Then we'll look at some of the parts of the sutra. We're not going to read through the whole sutra. We'll read through some important parts. And then we'll do the breathing. Did everybody practice the breathing at home with the heart?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah. How did that go? How did people feel with it?
The homework was to use the breath and intention of the mind. And what I tried something different, I visualized my breath while I was exercising. I have a trainer come to my house, and I visualize my breath with the intention to not get out of breath, because I couldn't do my burpee. And I can tell you, I could never do 10 burpees, and I did 20 burpees, and I could do another. I literally could do more. I mean, I wasn't out of breath. And so then what I did, I took it to another level. When I went walking, I go for a 5-mile walk, and on my neighborhood in the hills is really, really high. And I always struggle. And I did the practice of visualizing my breath. And I didn't even notice I ran out of breath. And I finished my walk without even notice. Wow, I'm done already. So I wasn't thinking about anything, but just visualize my breath while I walk for 5 miles, and it actually really helped. It was like a calming, and I finished it immediately. It's sooner than I thought.
Great.
So I think that something with that.
Yeah, the exercise. Yeah, that's fantastic. Anybody else?
Hi, it's Kat. I did the breathing with my heart exercise, you know, just really visualizing that, because I take hypertension meds, and I have for years. And, you know, I can check, monitor my blood pressure and decrease and increase. And so I figured, you know, that would help a lot in visualizing, you know, the blood going through my circulatory system. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, you know, I normally wake up with my fingers tingly going to sleep, and it hasn't happened. It did happen this morning, but it hasn't happened the rest of the week. So
good. Excellent.
Improvement.
Yeah, fantastic. Johnny, you were going to say something?
When I did, it sort of, it spread all around.
Which, oh, good.
Was a wonderful sensation. Yeah.
Good. Sam?
I've been hurting a lot after this fall that I had, and my body's been in a lot of trauma, and I definitely saw a shift this week.
Oh, good.
From the breathing. Yeah.
Good.
And I did it every morning, and I could feel my energy level changing. So yeah, it was really good.
Good. I'm glad you've had these experiences and you've shared them with us. Thank you. It really points out to what a powerful tool the breath is. This is nothing new, and it's certainly not exclusively Buddhist by any means. It's been used in every single tradition, because it's not hard to miss how connected breathing is to what and who we are and our life. What was really different about the way the Buddha presented it, well, I don't know if it's different. One might think it differently, but one might think it's just a parallelism, is that the Buddha really introduce the possibility that the breath can be a doorway that can completely dismantle our illusions about what's real and what's not real, and give us a true picture of what reality is. In shamanistic traditions, they use the breath to go into their vision quest. In also other religions and other traditions, for example, chanting is a very powerful use of the breath, and mantra is a very powerful use of the breath. Gregorian chanting, if you've ever heard Gregorian chanting, is using the breath. So good. We'll be working with that, talking about that a little bit more later. So one of the things that's very important that I want to share is that everything that I'm sharing with you now you please keep in mind, it's my understanding and expressions of what I've experienced. And I'm going to accept full responsibility for any errors or misinterpretations or representations which some may feel are present. And if any of you at any time feel that there is something about this, then please let me know and let's talk about it. Let's consider it, because not everybody presents these subjects in the same way. In fact, many people present them in very different ways. Now, is that a good thing? Is that not a good thing? Is it avoidable? That's a good question. In my mind, there's going to be certain similarities. So today's subject is why philosophy? Why practice spiritual practice? It's a big subject. And what's so important about it? And especially I want to emphasize why the path to wisdom approach is different. And that's a very simple response. And that is, at Path to Wisdom, what we're trying to create is an emphasis on practical application of philosophy, not on just discussing things. The what ifs, how can we look at this? And by this is what's truth, this is existential, this is epistemology, which means what we know by what we learn, this is ontology, this is what's been given to us down from God, etc. It's not just about discussion and theories and process, it's about actual practical applications. And every philosophical tradition, including the Buddhist tradition, including the Taoist tradition, including the Socratic tradition, including the Pythagorean tradition, including some ancient Egyptian, ancient Babylonian, they had practical tools to accomplish what they talked about. Unfortunately, a lot of that has been lost for many, many different reasons. And so the goal of what Path to Wisdom is trying to do is to bring that practice back into the forefront. But in order to do that, the first thing one has to do is to kind of define what you want to do with it. Where do you want it in your life? Is it something you want to come once a day, once a week on a Sunday and have a very interesting stimulation? Or is it something that you want to engage in more on a day-to-day basis? I spoke about this last time, and I think I'm going to refine what I'm saying about it this time. And this is something that's very much happening as I'm actually presenting these discourses, which is what I started with before everybody was logged in. I'm finding this whole process really amazing for myself. We're all travelers on that path to try and find what it is we're looking for. What I'm presenting here is not the essential Buddha Dharma, because the essential Buddha Dharma, from my understanding and my current thinking, is going into homelessness, is becoming a bhikkhu for a male or a bhikkhuni, which means giving it all up. Two robes, one to cover you, one to keep you warm, one bowl to accept whatever people give you to eat, and some place where you can go sit or sleep. That's it. And a lot of people, I think, have struggled with that over the last 2,500 years since the Buddha began teaching it and trying to put is a metaphor almost to say a square peg into a round hole. So they've shaved off the corners so that it fits into the hole that works with their culture, with their relationship, with their society. And we are always taught, and by we, I mean those of us that have done apprenticeships, have been, you know, part of the formal tradition, as I was when I was younger, that that's the brilliance of the teaching of the Buddha Dharma, that it can adapt to anybody. And anybody can adapt it what their need is. I now have a very different view on that. I now see that what the Buddha taught is pretty clear. And his goal was for people who want to, you know, leave and go into homelessness and find what real reality is. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't study it and practice it, because there are other benefits for us along the way. So what I'm sharing is really my experience of what I've learned with my teacher and then applied these methods to my life over the last so many years, and how the person who is living the life more or less of what we call a householder, which is all of us, because none of us are monks or nuns or bhikkhus, because a monk and a nun is not necessarily, in my opinion, a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni. A monk or nun can be an official of a very formal temple, and that to me is not at all what the Buddha taught. But how we can apply these methods to our lives to find out more about who we are, and what will make us happy and fulfilled in our life. So the question then arises, what is the measure of a life? Why should we even pursue spiritual practices? Why should we choose to live a certain way or do a certain thing? Why is this more desirable than doing something else? All these questions are very real questions. And certainly from a dharmic point of view, as at least as I understand it, no one has the prerogative or the position or the right to judge another person's choice of life, of how to live, no matter how violent or how compassionate or how loving or how evil. This is a very important part of the Buddha Dharma. There is no sin in the Buddha Dharma. There is no right and wrong in the Buddha Dharma. There is right view and wrong view, which means an understanding of reality, but it specifically refers to our perception of reality, not morality. But as I've expressed in previous discourses, ethics, or sila, as is in Pali, are the fundamental foundation for succeeding in the practice. So there is an ethic. It's not devoid of ethics, it's devoid of judgment. Does that make sense? Clear? It's not devoid of ethics, it's devoid of judgment. Because the minute we judge something, we're no longer perceiving reality, we're perceiving what we think in our head. And of course, when you're discussing with a person who's not familiar with the Dharma, they may say, well, that's all I have, what's in my head. That's my reality. From a Dharma point of view, that's not a given. That could be the way we've been raised, it could be the way we've emotionally been attached, or we've emotionally been bonded. And it's important when one has discussions of these nature, both amongst us in the Sangha and with other people, that when we're discussing this, we're talking about things from a Buddha Dharma point of view, not from a political, not from a social or a legal point of view. I'll share with you something that occurred to me with my teacher. When I became very seriously, that meant not at the age of 7 when I started with my teacher, but when I was a teenager and started to be more an adult, a young adult in my late teens, early 20s. One day he came to me and he said, we were in discussion. He said, I'll support you 100% on everything with one exception. And I thought, why would you have an exception? You're my teacher, you're my a master. I'd bow down to you, become your disciple. But this is part of the deal. So, okay, what's that? I'll support you 100% in anything you do unless you get involved with a legal problem. If you get involved with a legal problem, I'll have nothing to do with it. Now, to a 21-year-old, that sounds kind of ominous because when you're in your late teens, early 20s, legal problems can be very frequent, whether it's getting caught doing something you shouldn't be or doing something you're trying to push the limits or demonstrating, protesting. And I thought, well, that's a bit odd. Isn't Buddhism about supporting the heart and the mind and tolerance? And when I brought this up to him, he said, the Buddha Dharma is about reality. The law is a temporal construct of the society in which we live. It's created by human beings for their own benefits, for their own goals. Therefore, it has nothing to do with reality. It has to do with what the people who created the law want from reality. Therefore, nothing from Buddha Dharma can help you with the law because it doesn't follow anything that's real. Now, if we spoke to somebody outside of this Sangha who has no concept of Buddha Dharma, they'd think, you're crazy. What are you talking about? Of course it's real. It's very interesting. So that is what the law wants. It has nothing to do with reality. The Buddha Dharma is not created for us to understand why Trump is elected or not elected. The Buddha Dharma is not for us to understand why certain countries do this or certain countries do that. Even the most horrific of things that occur or the most loving things that occur. So attaching Buddha Dharma to loving and new age type of feel good gratitude, that's not Buddha Dharma. That's nice, it's good. It's not saying that's not, I think it's good at least. Personally, I like that, but that's not Buddha Dharma. The Buddha Dharma is about saying in order to understand and end your suffering in life, the ultimate suffering, you need to understand what's reality. And in order to understand reality, you need to understand what you are, how you're constructed, what you go through, and why you react the way you do. And to do that, the first thing you can do is start to engage with your life and how you respond to things that are occurring to you, both externally coming in and internally going out. And the tool is the breathing, Anapanasati, combined with Satipatthana, understanding when I breathe in a long breath, it's a long breath. When I breathe out a long breath, it's a long breath. That's it. Starting at that simple place, we move to more complex analysis as we went through the Satipatthana Sutra until we're dealing with consciousness and perception and objects and how we see things. Understood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if this is the case, then why should we pursue spiritual practice at all? Why should we do the work that we're going to do? Why, you know, and some people say one should dedicate their life to improving human beings, altruism. Other people say that one dedicates one's life to more knowledge, to contribute to the vast storehouse of information that humankind has. And others believe that their life is their own prerogative to do with it what they please, to please themselves. It can be a hedonistic lifestyle of pleasure, or it can be a more exploitative approach to using others for our own benefit and improving our own existence, just taking what we want. That some people believe they have the right to lord over others and exploit others to take what they desire if they can enforce the taking. That's what a kingdom is, isn't it? A king can do what he wants. That's what some people elected officials, they can do whatever they want. And then still there are people who are altruistically oriented towards helping others. So again, the question, why does one live a life of any specific sort or style? And I'm framing this in the spiritual context. And for me, the answer requires that each and every individual make that decision for themselves. Up until we're capable of deciding, we're in the care of our parents. And our parents' responsibility is to give us the tools to decide. But if our parents say to us, that person looks like that, they're bad. That person looks like that, they're good. That's not a tool for surviving and learning how to live in the world. That's a tool for deluding ourselves that there's some inherent characteristic in these human beings. Now, if a parent says, that person abused me, and they abuse me based on a cultural belief, then we're saying, okay, that person abuses another person based on a cultural belief. It's information. So it stands to reason then that the criteria which each and every one of you choose to make your decisions on what is important or how to live is going to determine what you do in your life. For example, I came to the arrival point in my life through practical experience and what I've gone through, that there's something that I call, you've heard me say this before, a universal ethic. Sometimes in Chinese, they'll call it Tao, or in Buddhist terminology, they call it Dharma, the actual Dharma. For me, the experience is when I perceive, when I experience harmony with that principle, I experience complete contentment, fulfillment, and inner peace. That's unshakable even through difficult and unpleasant times. No matter how much suffering occurs, that feeling is not diminished or eliminated. And that's what, to me, tells me I'm moving in the right direction and doing the right thing. And so I've oriented my life with the decisions I've made to try and encourage and harmonize my actions with that principle.